September 11th, 2001, a day that changed history. Four planes went silent and off course. Two of those planes crashed into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Several columns were severed, and the jet fuel ignited fires that spread over several floors. About an hour later, millions watched in shock as both towers were suddenly and rapidly destroyed, killing almost 3,000 people, for whom truth and justice may have yet to be served. Hi, I'm Richard Gage, AIA, licensed architect of over 20 years and member of the American Institute of Architects. I'm founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, a nonprofit organization of well over 1,000 technical and building professionals. According to official government reports, the fires weakened the structural steel framing of both twin towers, leading to sudden, progressive, and total collapses. Unknown to most people, a third steel frame high-rise, World Trade Center 7, was also destroyed. Critical questions have been raised by more than 1,500 architects and engineers about the official explanations for the destruction of all three of these buildings. Along with more than 10,000 other concerned individuals, these professionals, collectively comprising more than 25,000 years of experience, have signed our petition. They're calling for a new investigation into the destruction of these three World Trade Center high-rises. This call is based on evidence that reveals a very different destruction scenario than reported by government engineers. This includes abundant scientific forensic data and eyewitness testimony that was omitted from the official reports. You'll be seeing this evidence and hearing from dozens of these technical experts, including many who are among the top in their respective fields. We at AE 9/11 Truth are inspired by President Obama's affirmation to the American people in his inaugural address. How do we accomplish this? We've done our best to fulfill the President's vision by using the scientific method, examining the evidence from the World Trade Center and developing unbiased conclusions from unbiased experts in their fields. Listen to the President provide his account of the pervasive political abuse of science.
And we have watched as scientific integrity has been undermined and scientific research politicized in an effort to advance predetermined ideological agendas.
As coherent sets of scientific facts are brought into focus by the experts, the data, and the witnesses in this film, you'll come to a much greater understanding of the events of 9/11 and will be in a position to draw your own informed conclusions. Also, psychologists, therapists, and counselors, along with theologian David Ray Griffin, who have a deep understanding of the personal issues associated with 9/11, will explain why it is so difficult for us to come to terms with the reality of these events and learn how we can help ourselves and others with this difficult yet vital responsibility. Of course, the ones still most affected by the events of that tragic day are the family members of the victims lost on 9/11. Several have asked to appear in this documentary. Although our focus will be primarily technical, we are deeply moved and honored to give them the opportunity to speak directly to you. Now, let's hear from the AE 9/11 Truth professional petition signers who will share with you what conclusions they came to. Among these experts are high-rise architects and engineers in the fields of structural design, material science, chemistry, fire protection, metallurgy, as well as physicists, explosives experts, and demolition technicians. Joining them will be firefighters and 9/11 victims' family members who support our call for a new World Trade Center investigation.
I don't want to be involved in conspiracy theories. There are lots of them. They can go on. We can speculate on that forever. What we really need to know is how those buildings came down.
My name is Joel Miller, and I have a Bachelor of Architecture degree from Temple University in Philadelphia. And while I was there in Philadelphia, I worked for two firms on a couple of high-rise buildings, the 13-story Federal Detention Center for Ewing Cole, Cherry, and Broad. I spent about 2 years on that project, and then a year on a high-rise dormitory, about 15 stories for MGA Partners. If we are to believe that fire brought down three buildings on the same day on 9/11, that's very troubling for all of us in the design professions, architects, engineers, even physicists. I'm incredulous that this could have happened and very troubled by the implications of this possibility. There are thousands of high-rise buildings in the United States and more being built every day in this country and abroad. As architects and engineers, we have a responsibility to protect people that are users of buildings.
The new World Trade Center, Building 7, looms above the site of its original. Building 7 was a 47-story high-rise, not hit by an airplane. Yet, it was the third modern steel-frame skyscraper to collapse rapidly and symmetrically on 9/11. It was a football field away from the North Tower and sustained minor damage from the falling debris. Building 7's precipitous collapse was blamed on normal office fires.
I'm Kamal Obaid. I have a master's degree in civil and structural engineering from the University of California at Berkeley. I've been a practicing engineer for the last 30 years. Building 7 to me is really what gives it away, because that's a classic case of controlled demolition.
My name is Stephen Dustewald. I'm a licensed professional structural engineer with 37 years of experience in the structural field. I have 25 years of experience as owner and principal of my own structural engineering firm here in Las Vegas. I have focused on nuclear power plant design, large commercial and industrial buildings. I first became aware of the problems with the official account of the collapse when I saw a DVD online from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. They pointed out various problems with the official story, and the ones that caught my attention were the rapid failure of the connections in order for the building to come down at the rate that it did.
My name is Casey Pfeiffer. I am a registered professional structural engineer in San Diego, California. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering at the University of Notre Dame. I have been practicing engineering for 15 years, and currently I am the principal of Pacific Coast Structural Engineering in San Diego, California. A friend of mine gave me a blueprint for 9/11 Truth DVD to review, and from that, the evidence that I saw was so compelling that it became obvious that the official story was not correct.
I'm William Bryce. I work for one of the nation's largest design-build construction firms on commercial and industrial and institutional projects in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore areas. As a professor, taught engineering materials, structures lab, and other building-related courses at Vermont Technical College to architectural engineering students for 20 years. I watched Building 7 fall at an accelerating rate in 6.5 seconds. This was a massive 47-story structure. The only way that a building can accelerate as it collapses is by having pre-engineered, precisely timed, and precisely placed explosives. In other words, controlled demolition.
My name is David Topete. I have a Master's of Science degree in civil engineering. I am a licensed structural engineer. I design new structures and retrofit existing structures from concrete or masonry or structural steel. In my professional opinion, in my experience, for World Trade Center 7-2 collapse straight down upon itself, as the video indicates, as everything that we've witnessed, the supports at the center essentially all had to be taken out at once. I certainly believe that it had to have been controlled demolition, controlled charges, explosives, something of that type, because it was a sudden failure.
I'm Dr. Bob Bowman, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Air Force, retired. Flew 101 combat missions in Vietnam, directed all the Star Wars programs under Presidents Ford and Carter. My PhD is in aeronautics and nuclear engineering from Caltech. I did postdoctoral work at the von Karman Institute in Brussels, Belgium, in finite element analysis. I taught at 5 universities and colleges, serving as department head and assistant dean. The coup de grace for me was when I found out that Building 7 had collapsed later that day. And when I saw Building 7 come down, to me, Building 7, the fact that it looks like a perfect controlled demolition of an intact building with no visible fires, I mean, that's what I call a smoking gun.
My name is Robert McCoy. I'm an architect, a Bachelor of Architecture from the University of California in Berkeley in 1963. Been licensed in California since about 1964. From about 1965 until about 1985, most of my experience has been in high-rise, multi-story steel buildings. NISP would have us to believe that these were was a typical office fire, scattered office fires, if you will, that brought this building down. Since the mid-60s, I've tried to follow high-rise fires because they're something we worry a lot about as we design these buildings. And I'm not aware of any high-rise building that have come down as a result of fires. I can't remember even a partial collapse in any of these buildings that I've watched over the years.
I'm Steve Barish, founder and president of Barish Architects and Associates, Inc., a 33-year-old architecture planning and engineering firm. We have offices in San Luis Obispo and Pasadena, California. I hold a Bachelor of Architecture degree from the University of Arizona and a Master's of Architecture in Urban Design from Rice University in Houston, Texas. Spent 3 years in London as the first PhD student at the Architectural Association. One of the things that really interested me is how quickly the Tower 7 fell. It fell within 7 seconds approximately from top to bottom. This building was built in the mid-80s, apparently, and met all the known codes at the time. Buildings just don't behave like that.
We're here in Sydney with Jan Utzon, son of the great Jorn Utzon, who designed the Sydney Opera House. What are the features of the collapse of World Trade Center 7 that caused you to be disturbed?
It looked like it was a demolition more than anything else.
My name is Les Young. I'm a licensed architect in both New York State and in California. I've been involved in many large projects, including overseeing several high-rise buildings ranging in size from 14 stories to 40. Over the course of 20 years, I'm mainly called in to help with very large, difficult projects. When I watched Building 7 collapse, it basically left no doubt in my mind that something was wrong. Building 7 had not been hit by a plane. To me, it was obvious that there was some controlled demolition and some explosions involved.
Was the structural steel from World Trade Center 7 preserved, documented, analyzed according to standard procedures for investigating engineering failures?
It was really clear from the beginning that there was this great move to, as quickly as possible, get rid of all of the rubble and move it off.
Because what they did immediately after 9/11 was they started removing the steel, the debris from Tower 7 and all the towers immediately. They sent it off to China to be recycled.
400 truckloads per day of material were taken away from the World Trade Center site and sent to China for
recycling.
All of a sudden they had a big incentive to recycle steel for some reason.
Quickly and rapidly, they were destroying the structural steel.
The steel was hauled away and melted down before it could be analyzed.
It was already being carted away and destroyed when the FEMA investigators got there about a month after September 11th.
It was being melted down, it was being cut up into pieces, so that no real thorough investigation could happen. And that in itself is a crime, and that kind of thing needs to be investigated.
The steel was picked up and carted away before anybody got a good look at it. And the destruction of evidence was a criminal act in itself. It would have answered a lot of questions that we can't answer because we don't have the structural steel to examine.
There were laws violated in the destruction of that evidence. And for the American Society of Civil Engineers to ignore those events is extremely disturbing and is a violation, in my opinion, of their professional code of ethics.
It was contrary to the way all investigations are done. If an airplane crashes, they seal off the entire area and nobody touches anything. They move it to a secure location and they reconstruct an aircraft.
Normally, when you have a structural failure, you carefully go through the debris field, looking at each item, photographing every beam as it collapsed and every column where it is in the ground, and you pick them up very carefully and you look at each element. We were unable to do that in the case of Tower 7.
Aside from this one small piece that was found to have intergranular melting, incredibly, none of the other steel from World Trade Center 7 was saved for analysis. This is disconcerting, considering World Trade Center 7 would have been the first steel-framed high-rise building in history to ostensibly collapse due to fire.
The government has destroyed much of the evidence, but there's still some evidence available in photographs of the evidence.
My name is Lynn Margulis. I've been doing science every day since I was about 16 years old. I teach at the University of Massachusetts. I have a PhD in genetics. I reconstruct the past natural history from clues taken to be representational, and that's exactly what we're doing with reconstructing of why the buildings were destroyed in 9/11. In the historical science, that's what must be done. In 1999, I was a recipient of the President's Medal of Science from Clinton, and I received the Da Vinci Award, that is the membership in the Da Vinci Society. You can't do science when you are deprived of the evidence and when your hypothesis is the least valid instead of the most likely. When the most likely hypothesis in the case of Building 7 wasn't even mentioned, this is not science. So the claim is that it's something else. It's trying to prove preconceived ideas.
Was a proper investigation performed that might have revealed the use of accelerants or explosives in World Trade Center 7's destruction?
My name is Stephen Jones, a physicist. I received my PhD in physics from Vanderbilt University in 1978, so I've been at this for over 30 years, studying various subjects. I have published over 50 peer-reviewed papers in my career. NIST concedes that they found no evidence for explosives. So then we asked them, well, did you look? And they said, no, we did not look for explosives or residues of explosives.
I'm Ron Brookman, licensed structural engineer in California, and I received my master's degree in structural engineering from University of California at Davis in 1986. I've been practicing structural engineering ever since then. NIST never did a proper evaluation of the collapse site and the debris. World Trade Center 7, I would have expected they would have tested for explosives also because of the nature of the collapse and the unprecedented nature of a steel-framed high-rise building collapsing in such a fashion.
My name is Roland Angle. I'm a civil engineer registered in the state of California. I've been practicing in California since 1967. I'm a graduate of the University of California, and my practice has included, among other things, design and testing of structures that were designed to withstand blasts. Specifically, for instance, the launch facilities for the Minuteman missile system. I was a Green Beret for 6 years during the 60s. I was trained in the use of demolitions, and I blew a lot of things up. One of the things that we did was go out and attack structures, analyze them as to where their weak points were, learn how to place explosives at points that would cause them to fail, and then actually demolish them and analyze our results. So the method of how to attack a structure and cause it to fail with explosives was one of the things that I learned through my military training. Well, the American Society of Civil Engineers was brought into this investigation early on. They did a very superficial investigation of the site. They issued a report without any significant forensic examination, and there were laws violated in the destruction of that evidence. And for the American Society of Civil Engineers to ignore those events is extremely disturbing. And is a violation, in my opinion, of their professional code of ethics.
I'm Tony Zambodi. I'm a mechanical engineer from the Philadelphia area with over 20 years of experience in the aerospace industry, where I design structures for aircraft and spacecraft and support equipment. Neither NIST or FEMA followed standard protocol for fire and explosion investigations, or just fire investigations for that matter. National Fire Protection Association Guide Number 921 calls for saving the evidence and being prepared to justify why you wouldn't. It also calls for testing for accelerants and explosives when high-order damage is involved. NIST did not do this. NIST is often responsible for generating information which the NFPA guides are written from. It makes one wonder why the NFPA standard would not be followed in this case. This has not answered this question publicly.
There's national standards that need to be followed. And when I started looking into that, I went into the investigation manual. And so it's called the NFPA 921, and it's the fire and explosion. It's the guide for fire and explosions investigations. And so what it is, it's a national standard. So if an investigator from New York has to come out to the West Coast to help with something, they can fit right in seamlessly into the system and know where what their role is and what they need to be doing. And so I went and I got the manual from 2001, and I went back and I looked at the footage from the original day of 9/11, there were all kinds of firefighters and civilians that were reporting explosions.
Okay, all right. Here, hold on. You want to call your mother or something?
Keep your eye on that building. It's coming down.
Just the fact that there were explosions means they need to be investigated. Terrorists used explosives in 93. We had witnesses to explosions. We have audio recording of explosions. We have overwhelming evidence that there were some explosive events. The manual gets into thermite, and if it says if you have melted steel or concrete, which we had on 9/11, and there's videos of it, people can see it, we should test for it. It says when you have melted steel or concrete, you test for thermite. So the fact that they're not testing for it is crazy. We had 3,000, you know, Americans murdered, and we had the first three high-rise and steel collapses. We have all these reports of explosions. We have the vans pulled over. We have the history of terrorists using explosives. It's absolutely ridiculous that there's no excuse for it. It's criminal, in my opinion. It's absolutely criminal that they refuse to follow the national standards, and the national standards say that they should be testing that for explosives. One of the other big issues we have, the firefighters that are members of the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, is the just the blatant destruction of evidence. It's we're not talking about a little bit of evidence. They destroyed all the steel, all the basically the bones of the building that would have told us how this first high-rise steel structure in history that hadn't been struck by an airplane, all it had was a few fires on several floors, and it had only been burning for a few hours. We've had other high-rises burn much longer. This was the way we could have learned from this was analyzing that, looking at the steel and seeing how this collapsed and how it failed and which steel members did what. Well, we can't do that because what they did immediately after 9/11 was they started removing the steel, the debris from Tower 7 and all the towers immediately. Why were they destroying this? I mean, they sent it off to China to be recycled. So they never had any physical evidence to do the investigation. The national standards are very clear. We have preservation of evidence. We have spoliation of evidence. There's all kinds of basically standards that you don't destroy evidence. So that's what we're calling for. We're calling for an investigation into the investigators, why they destroyed this. We're calling for a reinvestigation that follows national standards. And the big thing is everybody says this is in the past, leave it in the past, and that's not true. We have Ground Zero workers dying today. They're getting cancers. And several of them don't have medical insurance. The FDNY, most of them are being taken care of by the department, but there were so many thousands of volunteers and members of other departments that showed up, and they were there for months afterwards, and they don't have the medical coverage. They can't make their house payments. They're sick and dying, and we as a country are ignoring them. I mean, we promised we'd never forget, but it looks to me like most people have forgotten, and they want us to forget, and that's what we're here for, is to basically just ask people to take another look into this, you know, show some compassion, and let's help, you know, our brothers and sisters out and really reinvestigate 9/11. I mean, we have, it's changed our world. It's, you know, not to mention that there were 343 brothers murdered, but we're at war over this. We've lost a lot of our freedoms over this, and we don't have the real story on what happened because there wasn't a proper investigation done.
As reported by the New York Times, engineers were baffled by the collapse of Building 7. Since no steel frame high-rise has ever completely collapsed due to fire, how are we to understand this mysterious event?
My name is Scott Granger. I'm a licensed fire protection engineer. I'm licensed in 13 states. I've been in private practice for 25 years. I've been a practicing engineer for 39 years. 50% of my practice is in forensic engineering. Steel structural frame buildings, high-rise buildings, simply do not collapse due to fire. There has never been, until 9/11, an experience where a high-rise building that was steel frame completely collapsed. There have been fires burned longer in similar structures without any collapse.
In my previous career as a firefighter, normally you'd never be afraid to go into a Type 1 building because they're not combustible, and you would just charge at it and put the fire out. Never in my training were we ever taught that these type of buildings could just collapse in on themselves. There's definitely much more going on than just fire.
The way in which steel-framed buildings behave in fires depends on their construction. In this test, done by British Steel in 1995, a large amount of typical office furniture was burned to see what would happen to the heavy steel beams that supported the ceiling.
When steel is bare, when it heats up, it gets weaker. It's not that it melts in a fire. In fact, normal fires are not hot enough to melt steel. Even if you were, for example, to use an unusual fuel like kerosene, you cannot achieve temperatures hot enough to melt steel. But what happens is it starts to lose its strength. And as it loses its strength, it starts to sag. It becomes softer and sags and can no longer support the load.
This was the largest test of its kind ever conducted. It showed how unprotected steel can be distorted, even by a normal office fire. But as is typical in steel buildings, the structural beams only slowly and progressively warped and sagged. There was no chance of a sudden collapse.
In over 20 years, I have not seen, until recently, a protected steel structure that has collapsed in a fire.
The World Trade Center 7 building reminds me of the Meridian Bank building in some ways in Philadelphia. The Meridian Bank building is a 38-story skyscraper that burned for 18 hours in 1991, suffered extensive damage from the fire, but did not collapse.
I am Dan Barnum, FAIA, a graduate architect from Rice University with a Bachelor of Architecture degree. For the 40-plus years that I've been practicing architecture, I have designed a variety of buildings from small houses to high-rise office buildings. Some of the high-rises that I've worked on are one shell and two shell here in Houston, and I was project manager for a 22-story office building in Akron, Ohio. I'm a fellow of the American Institute of Architects. I've designed high-rise buildings, and I know what they do in fires because I've studied that. Later in the day, when World Trade Center 7 collapsed, they had already showed us pictures of a few fires in that building, and I mean, they weren't even raging. And how could that cause a building to collapse as if it were imploded? Couldn't happen.
My name is Jonathan Smolens, PE. I'm a professional structural engineer in the Boulder, Denver area for the past 12 years. And one of my specialties is forensic engineering, including evaluation of structures post-disaster. What happened to those columns to all collapse at the same time? The explanation provided does not match the evidence that we have.
My name is Michael Donnelly, PE. I'm a structural engineer with 14 years of experience. I get involved mostly with the design of steel-framed fireproof buildings. We've never had a steel-framed skyscraper collapse in the United States or internationally, so there's no precedent. I don't think Building 7 could have collapsed by fire, as NIST tells us that this collapse mechanism, starting with thermal expansion that worked its way upward and outward through the building, in a matter of seconds, there's not enough time for the building to collapse the way that NIST tells us it collapsed.
I'm Ed Moniak, licensed fire protection engineer for the at least 25 years, and I work for a number of organizations, city, federal, large insurance companies, consultant, always in the area of fire safety, and with the goal of keeping the public safe and first responders safe. I became fascinated with the government's version of the events on 9/11, because this is totally contrary to everything that I've ever experienced, either working in the field of fire safety or knowing what I know about mechanical engineering. It defies many fundamentals of mechanics and materials and physics and just many fundamental engineering concepts.
World Trade Center 7, this claims the fires were very large, very hot, and long-lasting, when in reality, observation, which has been researched by many people, shows these fires did not last very long. They were not in the locations where NIST claims they were at given times.
According to lead investigator Sham Sunder of the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, World Trade Center 7 collapsed at freefall acceleration for more than 100 feet of its fall. What does the speed of the collapse reveal to us?
Essentially, in less than 7 seconds, Tower 7 came down upon itself.
Building 7, NIST reports admits, fell at the rate of gravity for the first 100 feet. Well, that's impossible unless there's nothing resisting it.
It's just like taking your car keys out and just dropping them. That's how fast the building came down, for over 100 feet. And the only way you can get that is when there's zero resistance. And so what we're looking at is a building just coming straight down, falling right through itself with zero resistance. Buildings don't have zero resistance, which is why you feel comfortable walking into a building.
A building cannot do free fall with a huge steel structural system in place to support it without it being blown up. That's the only way it could could come down at free fall.
The failure of all these connections as the primary means of structural failure is inconsistent with a natural gravitational collapse and indicates the presence of other agents which would dismember these connections.
I'm David Chandler. I have a bachelor's degree in physics from Harvey Mudd College and a master's in education from Claremont Graduate University and another master's in mathematics from California Polytechnic University. I've been teaching for over 30 years. Heard people say, well, it came down at free fall or close to free fall and so forth. So I decided I'd measure it myself. I had a simple tool at the time called a physics toolkit, which allowed me to take a video and put a dot on each frame to follow the motion of things. And so you can measure speeds and accelerations, and it'll do the analysis. The fundamental laws of nature is the conservation of energy. In order for it to be falling down with zero resistance, it means that resistance had to have been removed by something else.
And NIST claims that the columns were buckling in the first several seconds before the free fall occurred. Now, I don't see that how that's possible.
And in the final report, they modified it. They tried to doctor it up. They still tried to say that it was essentially correct, but then they modified it, and they actually admitted there was a period of free fall involved. But they never changed their model. Like, how do you all of a sudden allow for free fall when they just got done explaining how it couldn't have been in free fall? If I were a scientist, I'd be embarrassed to try to put forward something like that. It was clearly a fraudulent argument.
In other words, NIST is telling us that the building below it ceased to exist for the first few seconds of the collapse of the building. Well, things in physics just don't cease to exist and cease to resist the forces that are on them.
Free falling for 8 stories. So, we know that happened. Okay, it's been measured and it's on videos. Everyone can see it. NIST has admitted it went into free fall for 8 stories. That's a bothersome part of the puzzle because NIST never explained it.
Absolutely no resistance to the descent whatsoever.
The building didn't disappear so the building can fall for 100 feet at free fall speed. That's impossible. That's a violation of the fundamental law of physics that says that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So that evidence alone would indicate that the official story doesn't hold water.
There was no time for this elastic deformation and plastic deformation, which would have absorbed energy and decreased the descent to less than free fall speed. As energy is drained away from the system to deform those members, it would slow down the descending mass and cause a descent at less than free fall speed.
40,000 tons of structural steel in its structural system, and that is intended to keep it from going anywhere. A building cannot do free fall with a huge structural steel structural system in place to support it.
There's no resistance until the building is down maybe halfway.
Buildings tend to be delayed as they collapse. They don't just pancake down like this in a very short period of time.
If the pancake theory works, it's going to hit hesitation, and there was no hesitation.
Going from motionless to free fall instantly.
One continuous motion. There couldn't have been any structural resistance.
Buildings just don't behave like that. If floors fall, they tend to fall and are braced by the floor directly beneath it. And there's some delay there.
This is inconsistent with the energy redistribution that would be required from the descending mass to the remaining structure.
Completely impossible. And NIST themselves have to recognize the implications of this. The fact that they haven't is fraudulent.
The connections are designed with a safety factor of 1.5 to 3 times the failure load for the member. This assures that the member will always fail first. First in an elastic mode and then a plastic mode.
Ideally, the member would fail before the connection. You don't want the connections to fail first.
The connections failed first without any of the members exhibiting large deformations or deflections. Over 400 connections per second had to fail in order for the members to be released and for the structure to descend at almost free fall rate.
To fail at the rate that they did progressively across the building, even if a floor were to collapse, it still wouldn't be able to collapse all of the connections simultaneously at the rate that it did without secondary explosions.
There's no hesitation. There was no hesitation when it was to hit story after story.
If you were to look at a standard moment frame steel connection, which is a welded connection between the beam and the column, it would take on the order of around 500,000 pounds to shear off one connection. And if you multiply that by 400, put maybe a safety factor of 4, you would require 50 million pounds of force per second in order to collapse the building the way it was shown based on the NIST report and what we saw on the video evidence of the video of the building that day. It's highly unlikely. Don't know how that could ever happen without secondary explosions. It's not logical or reasonable.
The fact that it's coming down at free fall says all of the energy is being used to just make it go straight down, which means it's coming down through itself and not breaking up the building as it goes. Something else has to be clearing the way. And that is smoking gun evidence to me. I think that's one of the primary pieces of evidence that these buildings really were demolished. They weren't just accidents that happened.
We might anticipate that an unevenly damaged building would fall over. Yet, videos of the collapse of Building 7 show a fairly symmetrical fall. How do we make sense of this?
The exterior of the building comes down fully, symmetrically, and at one time. Both sides of the building come down completely. This is fully indicative of full structural support being removed for at least 6 stories. That could not happen by fire.
If, you know, if there was some fire in one corner, it would have collapsed maybe in that corner, but not the total building free-falling.
If the buildings had come down by fire, we would have seen a more natural progression of collapse. We may have seen, you know, the buildings actually topple over to one side, certainly not coming down in its own footprint.
And clearly a more asymmetrical pattern should have been present.
The symmetry is the smoking gun. It cannot happen that when you have asymmetric damage, you will get a perfectly symmetrical collapse.
It would not have been a uniform collapse. The building might have partially fallen over, but the building would not have collapsed as it did. This doesn't make any logical sense.
For it to come down straight down upon itself, you would need to basically take out the supports at the center, at the core.
The exterior columns on the outside as well as on the inside at the bottom would have to be severed almost at the same time.
Well, that's another indicator that this report is very suspect, because I would have expected in a classic implosion, as I've seen numerous times, is the core to fail. My name's Tom Sullivan. I worked for Controlled Demolition Incorporated, CDI, the top-rated explosives demolition firm in the world. As an explosives loader, my job was to place explosives in the buildings to prepare them for demolition. I was licensed while in New York by the New York Fire Department to handle explosives. And I worked on major projects such as Seattle Kingdom, the Three River Stadium, Philadelphia Naval Hospital, and key span gas holders in New York. I would expect the center of the building to start moving first, and then as the implosion progresses, then the sides come in, then the rest of the building is involved. What I saw, it was a classic implosion. The center of the core, the penthouse area, starts to move first, and then the building follows along with it.
And there were so many columns in the building that were not affected by either the fires or the impact damage, and they all came down, just at once. So it's a little disheartening, and it's implausible.
When it's all finished, The outside walls from the lower floors are piled one on top of the other right in the middle of the building. Just like a house of cards if it were coming down.
Logic tells you that if you have a single failure at some random point in the building, that the entire building is not going to collapse. The collapse would have been a chaotic, random event. The building would have partially collapsed, possibly, but it didn't. There was a total collapse, and there's very few things that could explain that, none of which are addressed by the NIST report. According to NIST, the failure occurred at column 79 on level 12. This means, basically, as they're talking about a single columnar collapse or failure that resulted in a total collapse of the building. That just does not make any sense.
As a structural engineer, I don't believe that the failure of one column would normally bring down an entire building in the way we saw World Trade Center 7 come down, because of redundancy, because of all the other columns in the building that were not affected.
NIST provided computer animations in support of their fire collapse theory. But what do independent engineers say about these animations?
When you observe the footage of how the building failed, and when you look at the animation of the failure, and compare that to what you actually observe in reality, I think they disprove their own theories. It is impossible for it to fail the way they said.
I've seen the animation sequence from the National Institute of Standards and Technology for their model, their mathematical model of the collapse of Building Number 7. And they have the inside members that one column gave way, which they claim resulted in the collapse of all the surrounding members, and then this precipitated a global collapse.
The NIST computer model, actually, they had done a bunch of finite element models of the connections, individual connections, so they had connections failing before the members failed. Four-part connections, when three of the four parts failed, they considered it to be all failed.
The exterior of the NIST World Trade Center 7 computer simulation model, which they put together to try to explain their theory, shows large, very large deformations, which are not observed in the video of the actual event. Yet they don't attempt to explain this in a report on why their model doesn't represent or replicate reality. What's actually happening with the NIST computer model, it's behaving like a natural collapse would. It would be deforming the exterior of the building if the whole interior was collapsing prior to the exterior. What we're seeing is what would happen in a natural collapse. And what we see on the real video is not a natural collapse.
So I think that the NIST model is flawed. Of course, they won't release all of their parameters that they use to model the collapse. And that is a primary problem for them.
NIST has also repeatedly refused to release computer input data that was requested through the Freedom of Information Act from them in the past concerning World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7.
What do these professionals conclude about the destruction of World Trade Center Building 7?
There had to be some agent that was destroying the connections in Building Number 7 at 400 connections per second, and the only thing that I can see that would be capable of doing this would be explosive devices at the connections. And this is why I think that there has to be a new investigation to find out the real physical causes for these all these members to act in an atypical fashion.
And I certainly believe that it had to have been controlled demolition, controlled charges, explosives, something of that type, because it was a sudden failure.
Controlled demolition. There's no way that fire did what they said it did to that building. Impossible. Couldn't happen. It just did not make sense that a building that had a few minor fires in it could possibly succumb the way it did. If there was damage, it would have been minor. There might have been some deflection of a beam or two here or there, but not a total and unequivocal complete collapse. It just doesn't ring true.
A few fires in that building, and I mean, they weren't even raging. And how could that cause a building to collapse as if it were imploded? Couldn't happen.
To me, it was obvious that there was some controlled demolition and some explosions involved.
When I saw Building 7 fall, it, to me, appeared to be controlled demolition because it fell in free fall manner into itself. It is my opinion, as a former 12 Bravo combat engineer, well trained in the use of explosives, that this building, all three buildings, were brought down as a control, as a result of controlled demolitions.
This is the original site of the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Construction is now underway where dramatic new facilities are being erected. Just 10 years ago, the planes hit the towers, cutting through some exterior and interior supporting structural steel columns. The fuel from the planes ignited office fires across several floors. According to the official reports, the structural steel frame was weakened and failed, causing a total progressive collapse of each tower. Does the official explanation make sense? Was there a comprehensive investigation that examined all of the evidence? Let's look at the details.
These buildings were designed to take multiple impacts from airliners.
I walked into the office, and the first words that I heard was, a plane's just run into the World Trade Center. And my initial thought was, well, that's okay. It's built to withstand a 707.
He stated that the fuel would be dumped into the building, but the building would still be there, although most of the fuel blew out the opposite side of the building.
These buildings are built to handle several times the load above them. Those perimeter columns could handle five times the load above them, and the core columns could handle three times the load above them.
The majority of the jet fuel was burnt up instantly in the big fireball, and it was gone. The fires that were left were office furnishings and carpet and things like that. A lot of things in these kind of buildings have to be fire resistant by nature. It's required by code. So there really isn't a whole lot of fuel in there to begin with.
The media portrayed these fires as being extremely hot, but the fires were not that hot in World Trade Center 1 and 2. If you look at the NIST zone data, you could see this. And to use our own powers of observation, you could tell by seeing these fires and seeing black smoke come out the windows, that means that the fires were oxygen-starved, and it was incomplete combustion. And so it was a low-temperature fire.
I am Robert Podolsky. I have a master's degree in theoretical physics from Xavier University in Cincinnati. I worked for 10 years as a professional physicist, engineer, systems analyst for government and for industry, companies like Avco, GE, Bendix, and also Air Force Avionics Lab, and the Coast Guard Electronics Division. I looked up in a manual the burning temperature of jet fuel and found that under the conditions that existed at the World Trade Center on 9/11, that jet fuel had to have been burning at about 750 degrees Fahrenheit. I also noticed that the official explanation of what happened there was that the heat from the fire supposedly softened the steel and thereby brought the buildings down. If you have a flame at 750 degrees, you can hold that flame under a steel beam forever and you'll never reach a high enough temperature to bend steel, let alone melt it. So immediately I knew at that point that the official explanation was dead wrong. There was no way those flames could have possibly brought about the collapse of the building.
It did not seem possible that these towers that were designed to withstand the impact of a 707 could possibly collapse in such a short order of time from the time that they were hit. There's no way the building was designed to take the impact of one, if not more, multiple airplanes. They were designed to withstand hurricane force winds of up to 140 miles an hour.
My first reaction was, that looks like controlled demolitions. However, I believed the official story because it was played to me over and over again. I heard repeated experts telling me that this was terrorists that did this and that it was planes that brought those buildings down. So I accepted the official story.
The NIST testing of the Twin Tower floor assemblies done at Underwriters Laboratories, this was done per ASTM E-119 in a two-hour, 2,000-degree fire test. During the test, the main trusses sagged approximately 4 inches after 60 minutes and 6 inches after 100 minutes, yet NIST had the main trusses sagging well over 40 inches in their models.
Rather than a slow, groaning collapse that we might anticipate, the Twin Towers show, in the videos, a very rapid, sudden onset of destruction. What does this imply?
I'm Frank Conan, a practicing civil engineer in the state of California. I have a Bachelor of Science from Chico State, which I received in 1988. I've been a licensed civil engineer since 1993. I specialize in bridge construction, retaining wall construction, small building construction, bridge demolition, and I have experience in bridge design and building design. Structural steel is required by building and design codes to prevent catastrophic failure and loss of public life. Everybody's seen the building collapses on 9/11, and it was shocking how fast the buildings collapsed.
The way the buildings fell was not indicative of the way a building that's in distress collapses.
This doesn't happen with structural steel buildings and never has and never will again. We assume that fires could destroy a building. Why people select steel buildings is because they would destroy slowly. It would gradually twist and bend and give people plenty of time and safety in getting out of the building.
The basic philosophy of the building codes in the last 75 to 80 years has been to ensure ductile failure of the members to provide for the public safety. Under this philosophy, members that are overloaded will deform elastically within the elastic range of the material with increasingly large deformations and deflections. This gives rise to large deformations that are visible and apparent to the occupants of the structure, and this gives them time to evacuate the structure.
I would not have expected the whole building to just give in at once. And I thought it rather odd that they fell almost perfectly in very similar ways. It seemed odd that lightning would strike twice.
Upon further review of the videos of the tower's destruction in the 9/11 Blueprint for Truth DVD, I was surprised to see the upper floors of the North Tower, the upper 15 floors of the North Tower, implode prior to any destruction of the tower below, because it would be logical that as a result of the plane crash that the upper 15 floors would start to damage the floors below, not the floors above.
And it certainly would stay in the damage zone. It would not drop down through 80,000 ton of insulated, undamaged structural steel and do it in 12 seconds.
I discuss the NIST claim that the upper section of each of the towers crushed the lower section. However, when you watch video closely, in the case of World Trade Center 1, you'll see that the upper section disintegrates itself. Its lower stories are breaking up before it even impacts the lower section. It appears to be a controlled demolition of its own, of the upper section.
The tops of the buildings were basically disintegrated.
The top section, pushing on the bottom section, it's going to meet equal forces as it goes. Both sections are going to be demolished at the same rate. So by the time you've crushed up 15 stories below it, the top 15 stories are also going to be crushed. And so there's nothing left now to crush the rest of the building. So there's so many paradoxes here. A little tiny chunk of the building can't possibly fall and crush the entire structure below it.
Well, there's demolitions done in France, which use what we call the Vernage technique, where they take out a couple floors worth of columns with hydraulics. They take the columns out and they let the building, the upper section of the building, drop two full floors. And when it impacts the lower section, there's a very definitive, observable jolt, deceleration, and velocity loss.
You're looking for a jolt, that this thing, if it actually comes down and hits, you should be able to see the point at which they actually impact, because it would actually slow down the motion of the falling block.
And you can see it in the graph. It is not there in the case of the North Tower.
It never slows down. It accelerates the entire time. And that was what was extremely significant. So I published a paper about that. It's in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And so if you had the top section acting like a pile driver, if in fact it actually hit and made an impact, was effectively crushing anything, pushing hard on this core structure below it, the core structure is going to push back equally hard. And that's what's going to cause the top section of the building to slow down. But the fact that it's constantly accelerating downward is evidence that it didn't slow down. It's not actually hitting and engaging with the structure below it in any way that could demolish it. The top section is not crushing the bottom section of the building, or it would meet resistance.
I am Richard Heumann. I am a retired professional electrical engineer. I went to Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute and received the Bachelor of Electrical Engineering degree in 1954. I worked for Joseph Loring for 41 years and was principal chief electrical engineer for the World Trade Center complex. I was very familiar with the Twin Towers elevator systems because we took over conceptual maintenance and improvements of the elevator systems after the project was completed. I actually ran and rode up and down elevator shafts on the top of a car going 1,200 feet a minute. You could imagine the experience. I'm very familiar with the interior structure that surrounded the elevator shafts and the accessibility which the elevator companies had 24/7. The only way that I can see that the towers could have collapsed is that the interior columns were compromised. In Tower 1, unless my eyes were deceiving me, before the tower started collapsing from the top, the antenna started to fall. And the antenna, of course, was over the middle of the elevator shafts. And, of course, their access to the elevator shafts gave them total access to the surrounding core columns, the interior of the core columns.
NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, acknowledges that the towers came down at essentially free-fall acceleration. What are the implications of that admission?
The measurements have indicated that Tower 1 collapsed in about 11 seconds and Tower 2 collapsed in about 9 seconds. And the argument goes that this is essentially the rate at which free-fall would happen.
I had a friend that asked me if it was possible for the Twin Towers to achieve near free fall speed when they collapsed.
The Twin Towers could not have come straight down through the thousands of tons of structural steel through the greatest resistance, the resistance of 80,000 tons of structural steel at the speed of practically free fall. That just would not happen.
They're columns of steel around the exterior of the building and within the core, all of which are there to prevent the thing from falling down. And so even if something falls on it, it's not going to immediately just go pop, 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 pop like that floor by floor. If it's going to collapse, it's going to have to take some time to weaken the structure below it.
This structure was capable of holding 3 to 5 times the weight. And here it is falling through it with a resistance of only 1/3 of its weight. Roughly 90% of the resistance has been removed. And what's happening is the top section is not crushing down the lower section like a pile driver, which is the picture that NIST basically is painting. It's actually falling into material that's already been pulverized. It's offering very little resistance. It's just coming down through pre-pulverized material. One of the fundamental laws of nature is the conservation of energy.
There was no time for this elastic deformation and plastic deformation, which would have absorbed energy and decreased the descent to less than free fall speed. As energy is drained away from the system to deform those members, it would slow down the descending mass and cause a descent at less than free fall speed.
This is high school physics, and our whole society is being led to believe that these fundamental laws of physics, hard science, don't apply anymore. I think that should really frighten all of us.
Structural connections not only had to fail nearly simultaneously, but in sequential order.
The buildings fall at a speed which can only occur if the structure has been removed, the vertical structure.
This block accelerates straight down, or is it picking up speed downward continually? It doesn't slow down. It just continues to gain speed.
From what I understand, the buildings actually accelerated as they came down, meaning they were not getting resistance from these massive columns in the center of the core of this building. The core of this building was very heavy. They're huge columns, huge.
I could not see how those massive, very thick columns could just snap like that. I would have expected most of them to stay intact with the floors collapsing around them.
I'm Alfred Lopez. I'm a registered professional structural engineer in the state of Michigan and have been in private practice for 40 years with Lopez Engineering. I've worked on several high-rise projects with office buildings above parking decks and high-rise apartment buildings here in the Detroit area. I've done numerous investigations of failures of buildings because of fire and wind damage. I was shocked at how the buildings collapsed, but expected that they would have come down much slower, that they would have tipped over, that the whole thing did not make sense. And ever since then, I had a hard time believing that the fires did drop those buildings.
I thought that given the way the planes hit the building, one side would have given away first and it just would have fallen off or fallen over at a steep angle. But the way the whole thing just gave way at once and started to plummet down without slowing down as it went down, again, just like the controlled demolition I witnessed personally.
The area below the damage zone where the planes flew in and where the fire was, that area below that, those 80 or 90 stories, 80,000 tons of structural steel was not damaged in any way. Yet you stood there and watched it destroy itself, wiping out floor by floor all 287 structural columns as if they didn't exist underneath the damage zone.
I
According to the first responders' oral histories, which were reported in the New York Times, over 100 first responders reported sounds of explosions and flashes of light at the onset of destruction of both towers. These were not discussed in the NIST report. What did these eyewitnesses actually see and hear?
We have eyewitness testimony of firemen, policemen, news reporters, and occupants of the building to explosions, an enormous number of eyewitness testimonies.
There was a heavy-duty explosion
inside the lobby.
Was that a secondary explosion?
Yes, it was.
There were numerous secondary explosions taking place in that building. There were continuous explosions.
There was a secondary explosion, probably a device either planted before or on the aircraft that did not explode until an hour later.
Then there were secondary explosions and then the subsequent collapses.
It sounded like gunfire. You know, bang, 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 bang. And then all of a sudden, three big explosions.
50 consecutive bangs, and it went, fell down like a waterfall.
And we heard the noise associated with an implosion.
We heard a very loud blast, an explosion.
We heard a loud explosion.
At that point, we heard a large boom.
Do you know if it was an explosion or if it was a building collapse?
To me, it sounded like an explosion.
There was another major explosion.
All of a sudden, you hear explosion, and you could see the building starting to collapse.
Huge explosion that we all heard and felt.
We could hear a rumble, which was about 5 seconds long, preceding the actual collapse, and then a boom when each of those towers collapsed.
Just seconds ago, there was a huge explosion, and it appears right now the second World Trade Tower has just collapsed.
I was about five blocks away when I heard explosions.
Then you heard from far away, boom, boom.
And you heard the boom, 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 boom.
It was if they had detonated.
Yeah,
as
detonated.
As if they were planning to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
And it just started going pop. It just started going boom, 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 boom. And he goes, how fast? I go like firecrackers.
One of Miss Sether's excuses was that there were no blast sounds heard by witnesses or recorded. There's so many videos of witnesses from that day that report explosions. There's radio transmissions from the FDNY. We have the transcripts that were recorded, you know, back in 2001 of all these firefighters and first responders reporting explosions. There's no doubt they were heard.
In the oral histories of the emergency personnel taken down late 2001, in early 2002, there are over 100 individuals who make comments about seeing, hearing, and feeling explosions in those buildings. These oral histories were documented well before NIST started their World Trade Center investigation in September 2002. This testimony should have caused the presumption that there was a good chance explosive residue would be found and justified testing for it, rather than the opposite.
Reviewing the some of the eyewitness accounts and people hearing what sounded like explosions and things like that. Again, it didn't seem very plausible for any other type of cause for such an event.
It doesn't look like a collapse. It's like a huge mushrooming, billowing kind of an event. That whole thing looks nothing like a building falling down. It's a building being blown up, and it's being blown up progressively from the top down. That's what the physics shows.
The NIST acknowledges in their response to a request for correction that they are unable to provide a full explanation of the total collapse, yet they refuse to consider the possibility that explosives or some other form of demolition device could have been used to cause the collapses of the towers, and the fact that controlled demolition is consistent with all the available technical evidence. And the response to that request for correction is this simply saying they're unable to provide a full explanation for the total collapse, even though that was their task given to them by Congress.
The core structure of the building had to have been destroyed by other means.
FEMA documents a 1,200-foot diameter debris field around each tower. Videos show multi-ton steel sections of hundreds of individual steel pieces ejecting out of the towers at 60 miles an hour for a distance of 600 feet. They also show clouds of debris pulverized in mid-air. and isolated explosive ejections as many as 60 stories below the so-called crush zone. Videos also show the near total destruction of both towers. What does all this tell us about the forces and energies involved in the destruction?
The spread of debris in a large radius around each tower. What we see is an outward explosion of material beyond the perimeters of each footprint. And this is not expected, and it's not congruent with the reports of our government.
Debris that was shooting out for hundreds of feet in all directions, 70 miles an hour, leaving the 80th floor of the North Tower and making a fairly level trajectory, that to me is fairly alarming.
Large multi-ton beams were hurled hundreds of yards laterally. Gravity works vertically, not laterally.
The number I got was 78 miles an hour. So something's happening to throw these things horizontally at those kinds of speeds. And here it is trailing white smoke the whole time. It really is indicative of some kind of explosion.
The individual explosions that I noticed 20 and 30 and 40 stories below the collapsing structure, those are what we demolitions guys call squibs. And that's another characteristic that seems to be evident.
Well, in the case of the South Tower, you can see these jets of black smoke being ejected from many locations on many different floors above the level of the impact. There's a whole bunch of these squibs or puffs that are coming out the side of the building. And naysayers tend to say, well, that's just air being blown out the windows because you have like an accordion effect. It's been compressed. Well, it's going on at a lot of different levels at the same time. It's one thing. And if you're compressing it out here, if you're blowing out the windows down here, how are you getting the air pressure? I mean, it doesn't really work to say it's just air pressure. Estimated these are coming out faster than 100 miles an hour.
The impact of the floors pancaking upon themselves would create gushes of air out the side, but not the kind of explosive force that we saw that would throw I-beams across the street into the windows of other buildings.
The ejection of the materials out of the building, the manner in which it fell, the speed at which it fell, exhibited all the signs of demolitions and the completeness of the destruction down to their individual elements.
When the South Tower was destroyed, at first it looked like it was going to land in the street or take a building out next to it, and then all of a sudden it disappears in this huge cloud of smoke, which didn't seem to make sense at the time.
How can those steel columns, the massive steel columns that they are, supporting that weight of that building, virtually disappear? Why aren't they poking up straight out of that rubble at the bottom of the building?
As an architect, I would expect to see larger portions of the building floors, the decking, the steel decking, the concrete topping, much larger remnants of what the structural components of this building was. There were just small fragments of strewn steel components. There should have been much larger pieces for examination on the ground. After all, there was 110 floors in each building, and each floor plate was over an acre in size.
But the fact that it was all reduced to rubble and powder just did not make sense at all.
We have no explanation of how the concrete was pulverized. It takes an enormous amount of energy, way beyond what we have in aviation fuel.
There were two substations on the 108th floor, the 75th floor, and the 41st floor, and the 7th floor. At those eight locations, there were four transformers in each substation that weighed over 30,000 pounds. In the substations on the mechanical floors in each tower, the transformers would not explode on their own. They were air-cooled, dry-type transformers. And yet, after the collapse, there was, from what was reported, there was no evidence of them being found at the bottom of the towers. I wonder why. It was a shame that after the collapse that a forensic unit forensic engineering unit didn't go into the debris and try to find at that time why the towers had collapsed. I'm sure there was other evidence that could have given a better indication at the time that there was something else wrong.
In its report on World Trade Center 7, which came out in May of 2002, FEMA documents in Appendix C steel that has been melted and even partially evaporated, resembling Swiss cheese. What are we to make of this?
My name is Jeff Fair. I have a PhD in material science and engineering from the University of Minnesota. I have a BA in physics from Brigham Young University. I've worked with solid-state reactions. I've worked characterizing materials, semiconductor materials, thin films. I currently do a lot of work with nanoparticles as well as solid-state reactions. So Jonathan Barnett's study, which I thought was very well done and quite extensive, is all documented by FEMA in Appendix C in their BPAT report that was May of 2002. Unfortunately, it was never used in the NIST report.
My name is Jason Cheshire, and I'm a licensed professional engineer in the province of Ontario in Canada. And I have been working in the field of hydrometallurgy for the past 10 years. For a major company here in Canada. And I'd like to know why NIST excluded the document from FEMA in Appendix C that documented this the evidence of melting steel. Well, why is this not included? Why is this forensic evidence not being included in the report?
First of all, let's go back to your basic premise that there was a pool of molten steel. I know of absolutely nobody, no eyewitness who said so, nobody who's produced it.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel. Molten steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like lava.
Like lava.
From a volcano. Actually melted beams where it was molten steel that was being dug out.
Underground, it was still so hot that molten metal dripped down the sides of a wall.
And the cleanup was very difficult in the beginning. Steel was coming out red in certain areas from the first couple of weeks.
This fused element of steel, molten steel.
And they pulled off a big block of concrete, and there was a little river of steel flowing.
My name is Mark Basile. I'm a chemical engineer. I have a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering from Worcester Polytechnic Institute. I've worked for about 25 years in industry, and the majority of what I do is analytical work and figuring out what materials are composed of, why they are what they are, why they do what they do. There were sections of them that clearly showed melting. They had sections that were thinned away, and there were actually holes through them, and some of the ends were just melted away or even possibly evaporated away.
I'm Kathy McGrade. I have a bachelor's in metallurgical engineering from New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, which I got in 1979. I then spent the next 30 years with three startup companies. In an office fire, you cannot generate enough heat to melt steel. And yet we have evidence of molten iron in the microspheres, in the rubble pile, and the metal pouring out of the side of the tower.
We could have filled up the Twin Towers with jet fuel and burned it all up, and that does not cause a fire hot enough to melt structural steel.
My name is Gary Warner. I'm a mechanical engineer. I hold a professional certification from the Association of British Columbia. I worked as in the project engineering department of the casting plant of Elcan, the aluminum company of Canada, one of the largest aluminum smelters on the planet at the time. And in that smelter, we turned aluminum oxide into aluminum, molten aluminum. Molten aluminum is silver. It's not yellow, it's silver. It looks like mercury. The yellow molten metal that I saw pouring out of the South Tower is indicative of molten iron. I was a bit incredulous when I learned that NIST claimed that the molten metal was aluminum. I mean, it doesn't look at all like molten aluminum. It looks like iron, molten iron. That's what it looks like. And I've seen tons of it. We used to cast this in Alcan. They still cast it. I spent 2 years casting that.
I'm David Gregg. I have a master's and PhD in chemical engineering from the University of Illinois. Afterwards, I went to work for Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, where I worked there for more than 30 years. You cannot get a flame hot enough to start the metal, to molten, make it molten in the first place so that this other process takes off. I don't know of any mechanism for that. The only way that's known that a carbonaceous material can cause steel or iron oxide to turn into a molten metal is in a blast furnace. Yeah, and that's very different than what we had.
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which when ignited sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel. We know that open-air fires cannot burn hot enough to melt steel, but metal had melted at the base of the towers.
The next question is, how do you get the sulfur in these pieces of steel or in the debris? And that question is unanswered. There's a version of thermite called thermate, which has sulfur in the thermate to. And what the sulfur does is it's sort of like salt on ice.
Appendix C of the FEMA report describes sulfur residues on the World Trade Center steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Sulfur slightly lowers the melting point of iron, and iron oxide and iron sulfide.
And it just basically makes the steel melt at a lower temperature. So instead of having to bring the steel up to 1,500 centigrade, you can slice through it with material that's at 900 or 1,000 degrees centigrade. And if you do a search on Google for thermite and building demolition, you can find all sorts of wonderful devices that have been fabricated and invented that use thermite for building demolitions.
Thermite is, in the old-fashioned thermite, is a mixture of pulverized aluminum and pulverized rust. And if you can get this mixture to react, which is not so easy, it produces tremendous heat, and this is what you call an incendiary. An incendiary is something which can be used to destroy something by the means of heat, while an explosive is something which reacts at with pressure. It knocks things apart. Now, the old-fashioned incendiary is not an explosive. It is still used for military purposes for melting iron structures.
Practical applications of thermite involve things such as equipment decommissioning in the military. When they have a piece of artillery or a tank or something like that that they don't want to leave behind to the enemy, they throw what are called grenades, thermite grenades, down the barrel, let's say. But thermite does not explode. It simply reacts, produces large amounts of heat, and molten material.
In the case of thermite cutting charges, you would have heard far less noise since they are worked by thermal heating, melting of the steel, rather than an explosive cutting as in RDX charges.
I'm Kim Ireland. I have a degree in chemical engineering from Clarkson University in 1963. After graduating, I served 2 years as a reserve officer in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, where, among other things, I had training in explosives such as C4. I was involved in the industrial chemical industry for 20 years, with major companies. There were reports of molten steel having been seen in the rubble pile of all three buildings, and I knew that jet fuel, which is essentially kerosene, is not capable of melting steel nor iron. Kerosene or jet fuel burns at less than 1600 degrees Fahrenheit, and molten steel needs at least 2700 degrees Fahrenheit in order to melt.
The thing that most struck me about the 9/11 incident was following the incident, how overflights had detected with infrared camera 1400 degree Fahrenheit hotspots on the surface of Ground Zero. And that being there for a week, you know, indicates that there was something very hot going on below the surface.
Another question that may haunt the new Freedom Tower. According to USGS, they found as much as 6% of the World Trade Center dust consisted of tiny, previously molten iron spheres. What does this tell us about the temperatures generated in the tower's destruction?
My name is Adam Parrott, and I have a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from Queen's University. I've been working for an environmental consulting firm for a number of years. When the USGS collected samples of the World Trade Center dust, they found the iron microspheres. Insofar, the USGS does not have a valid explanation for the presence of these iron microspheres.
But I've independently seen thermitic activity within two separate independent samples of World Trade Center dust.
I'm Jerry Lobdell. I'm a retired physicist and chemical engineer. I have a BS in chemical engineering from Texas Tech, and I have extensive coursework in mathematics and physics from the University of Texas at Austin. I've had broad experience in analysis and applied research, 30-year professional history spanning physics, chemical engineering, statistical analysis and modeling, and operations research. So what do the microspheres contain? Iron is the main element, and then it has smaller portions of aluminum, sulfur, a trace of manganese, a trace of potassium. Most of them are less than about a tenth of an inch in diameter, and they're spherical, and they're found in all of the dust blown out of the buildings during collapse, no matter where in Manhattan that dust is picked up.
You must have had a much hotter heat source for you to get 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit in order to melt the steel, melt the iron, to get these spheres, these molten spheres. Your heat source must be something like a chemical reaction, an exothermic chemical reaction that reacts, in the case of thermite, reacts at 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
My contention, based on finding thermite residue in the dust, is that it happened before. It didn't happen after in the fires that ensued in the rubble pile afterwards. It's all the characteristics of the microspheres, along with what I see in the attack of the beams that were actually found, tell me that thermite was involved in melting those steel beams.
Out of the ashes of the World Trade Center devastation rises the Freedom Tower, whose foundation, however, is shrouded in question. For example, in the World Trade Center dust, an international team of scientists find an advanced form of highly energetic nanothermite composites. What is it, and where does it come from?
My name is Nils Harriet. I have a master and a PhD in chemistry, and I'm associate professor at the University of Copenhagen, and I have been so for almost 40 years. I have published close to 60 peer-reviewed papers in the best journals, and currently I'm involved with research X-ray time-resolved spectroscopy on time scales of 1 millionth of 1 millionth of a second. In the dust, we found what we characterize as unreacted thermitic material in the shape of some very tiny red-gray chips, which have different properties. Most importantly is they're still reacting, some of them. And in the reaction, they produce molten iron, which is the prime indication of a thermitic reaction. And such a reaction can be used to destroy steel structures. What we have found is a modern version of thermite, which we call nanothermite, which is produced in a different way. It is not just two powders being mixed. The material is actually built from the atom scale up. We call it the bottom-up procedure, which is what you do in nanotechnology. This has two consequences for the nanothermite, which separates, distinguishes it from the classical thermite. First, the ingredients are much smaller, which means they are reacting faster and they are more easily ignited.
The primary elements in the red material are aluminum, iron oxide, as well as silicon and carbon. The iron oxide appears in faceted grains, approximately 100 nanometers across. The aluminum appears in thin platelets, about 40 nanometers thick. It is the small size of the particles involved in this material that allow us to characterize it as nanothermite. In ordinary thermite, the particle size is much larger, and hence ordinary thermite is an incendiary, whereas as the particle size becomes smaller and smaller, it can become explosive. Superthermite is sometimes called. This red material contains also a significant amount of carbon, and the formulation of nanothermite as described by National Laboratory publications also implies the presence of carbon, very typically. The organic is used with nanothermite in order to produce gas, that is a very high-pressure gas that makes the nanothermite an explosive. We do have descriptions from the Livermore National Laboratory in particular of how they fabricated this material, but to fabricate it is not so easy. This is discussed in our paper in the Open Chemical Physics Journal published in April of 2009. So far, none of these papers have been refuted in the literature, the scientific literature. So that means they are unchallenged in the scientific sense. They stand as an indictment, really, of the official story of 9/11.
One of the things I'd like to stress about these chips is that they really shouldn't be there. They're not a natural formed agglomeration of aluminum from the aircraft or materials that were in the building and iron oxide that got knocked off. It isn't just a haphazard bringing together of iron oxide and aluminum, which is the basic components of thermite. This is a material that is made up of nano-sized particles that are all very uniform, very symmetrical.
The formulation of the gray chips is nano-sized. This cannot be paint. Paint does not have these exotic properties. It's impossible.
We do not know which role is played by the red gray chips that we found in the dust. But we know, and this was already totally clear before we started investigating the dust, that both explosives and incendiaries were used in the controlled demolition of World Trade Center. This is quite obvious because of other observations, the molten iron and other findings in the dust.
This is material that is of military use that really shouldn't be there.
And our whole society is being led to believe that these fundamental laws of physics, hard science, don't apply anymore. I think that should really frighten all of us.
Just all the other evidence of seeing flashes and explosions and the melted metal and the dust particles and with the chemical, the explosive chemicals found in the debris. There's just a lot of questions about what's been going on, and that these questions have not been answered or even addressed in any sort of full way.
My name is Rick Folks. I'm a structural engineer with over 40 years' experience in engineering. I'm a president of my own engineering business here in Arizona since 1983. Prior to that, I was a vice president with prominent engineering firms in the Phoenix area. I have experience designing large structures, including power plant structures, shopping center structures, schools, commercial buildings, you name it. I know structural design, and I know that on September 11th, when I saw those twin towers coming down, I knew there had to be more to the story than just a fire causing those failures. That had to be a controlled demolition that we were witnessing. The government has lied to us, and we need to get to the truth. Those victims deserve the truth. They deserve justice. What we have right now is a travesty of justice.
A Freedom of Information Act request to NIST by a registered structural engineer for calculations and analysis substantiating the walk-off failures of the horizontal girders from their seats at columns 79 and 81 was denied by NIST, with the claim that releasing this data might jeopardize public safety. How could it possibly jeopardize public safety to tell people in the industry, engineers who were responsible for designing these buildings, how this failure could occur?
That implies that anybody who requests or demands these calculations is a threat to public safety.
Science is never secret when it's done right. Science is a way of finding out that is self-correcting and involves many people. Science isn't science unless it's published, unless it's openly published and made available for criticism. The thing that's most important about science is that it's a way of knowing, and it's a way of knowing that anyone can participate in. At the end of any kind of science activity, people will agree that they have collected evidence that illustrates a hypothesis, and if the evidence is contradictory to the hypothesis, one has to abandon that hypothesis and look for another one.
The explanations from FEMA and from NIST don't add up, but there is enormous circumstantial evidence, circumstantial and actually physical evidence as well, that would lead us to a different conclusion. And the conclusion is controlled demolition.
It was a shame that after the collapse that a forensic unit, a forensic engineering unit, didn't go into the debris and try to find at that time why the towers had collapsed. I'm sure there was other evidence that could have given a better indication at the time that there was something else wrong.
Any honest investigator would be looking at this and looking for explosives and so forth. The NIST investigation didn't go there. They just would not look for explosives. There have been explosives found in the dust, in the debris, but this has been the work of independent researchers, not NIST.
And the physical chemistry of everything that I wrote about is consistent with no other hypothesis. And all of the testimony of eyewitnesses, all of the video evidence, supports only controlled demolition as the cause of all three World Trade Center buildings' destruction.
You don't have to be a chemical engineer to question that official story. It's very, very obvious. Both Building 7 and the towers were brought down by demolition. It couldn't have been any other possible way.
That conclusion I come to based upon, first of all, my training and my education, particularly my experience in blowing up major structures that had been designed to withstand blasts. The experience that I had gained in the military and as an engineer was irrefutable. Those buildings were brought down by explosives.
So the preconceived notion of NIST is that there's no evidence for explosives, and so there's no point in looking. That is the most unscientific thing that you can possibly think of, not to look because you don't expect to find evidence, and in fact the evidence is overwhelming. They state these conclusions for which there's virtually no evidence, and then they ignore conclusions that can be drawn from the evidence.
It is my opinion, as a former 12 Bravo combat engineer,
well-trained in the use of explosives, that this building, all three buildings, were brought down as a control, as a result of controlled demolitions.
Elevator company personnel had 24/7 access to the shafts, which is the normal time in the evening and early morning hours when they perform their maintenance. And, of course, their access to the elevator shafts gave them total access to the surrounding core columns, the interior of the core columns.
It took some kind of consciousness raising on my part before I was willing to look at the possibilities. And really, you need to go where the evidence leads.
We know we've been lied to about 9/11. We don't know for sure who did it. We don't know exactly how they did everything. And that's why we need a new investigation to find out. But in the meantime, there are things we do know. We do know that there was a massive cover-up, that there was evidence hidden and destroyed.
And given these conclusions, what remedy do these professionals recommend?
The three skyscrapers were taken down in a controlled demolition, and all we're asking for is a new investigation, and that NIST also will investigate the dust for remaining explosives.
At Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, that's what we're asking for. Is we're asking for an investigation that follows national standards.
I'm Jody Gibbs. I was licensed for general building and heavy construction as well as architecture over 35 years ago. I was educated at Yale University, the Harvard Graduate School of Design, the Yale Graduate School of Art and Architecture, and I taught at MIT as an adjunct faculty for a number of years in the Graduate School of Architecture. My reasons for looking and demanding and urging people to see that we get a judicial investigation are really very simple. No high-rise steel structure has ever been destroyed by a fire in the history of construction. We have eyewitness testimony of firemen, policemen, news reporters, and occupants of the building to explosions, an enormous number of eyewitness testimonies. Fourth, the buildings fall at a speed which can only occur if the structure has been removed, the vertical structure. We also now have the evidence of thermite and thermate explosives. Most of these things were not even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. It's for this reason I urge all architects and engineers to look into the matter, look at the evidence that is available, and sign on to the demands of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth in demanding that we get a judicial investigation.
I signed the petition for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth because I felt it was an organization trying to get it at the truth of what, in fact, actually happened, what brought those buildings down. So what I'm looking for is a new investigation where all of the original information and tests and hypotheses are reexamined, as well as the ones that have surfaced since, the new ones, including the allegations of controlled demolition.
I don't think any of us are pointing fingers at this time. We're just saying, let's reopen it. Let's look at it objectively. Let's look at the evidence, not these fabricated computer models and hearsay and all these predetermined conclusions. Let's really open it up again and investigate this thing properly and then come to conclusions.
In my 37 years of experience as a structural engineer, I've never seen modes of failure such as have been exhibited in the case of these buildings, and that's why I feel that we need a new independent investigation to explain the destruction of these three buildings.
I strongly support an independent investigation into what actually occurred. There are many problems, and in fact, as a forensic engineer, I can tell you that unfortunately, the government has destroyed much of the evidence, that we could do an appropriate investigation, and an investigation could be done that would be independent of the government, independent of all of the influences that obviously were in effect during the NIST investigation.
Based on the evidence available, I feel that we must demand a new investigation into the destruction of the World Trade Center towers and NIST itself.
Need to have an investigation of NIST themselves. I believe that
the reports that came out are not true. I believe there's a lot of, again, a lot of information that was omitted, blatantly or otherwise.
I strongly feel that an international commission should be formed to look at this matter in an unbiased manner and come to a conclusion that could be presented to the entire engineering community.
We have a professional responsibility, and I urge every engineer and architect and demolitions expert and anybody that has any knowledge in this field to examine the evidence and stand up and be counted, because the rest of the world is depending upon us.
I would like to see a real investigation. I'd like to see people on the inside who really know what happened. I'd like to see some of those come out. There's some very good scientists, I'm sure, at NIST, and their life's work is getting distorted and used for political purposes.
What happened on 9/11 is not something that is just going to go away. This is very pertinent to us today. I wish to further the investigation, and I want to make a difference because I want this to be a safe and better place for my children.
I signed the petition on the Architect and Engineers 9/11 Truth website mainly because I wanted to stand behind the families that lost people on 9/11. The 9/11 Truth movement was started by the families that lost loved ones on that day, and they were all out there alone screaming for help, and our own country was ignoring them and ignoring their needs and not taking care of them the way we should have after that happened.
We have not been told the truth. We deserve the truth, and so do the victims.
We need to come together again as a country. I believe that this one event split our country in half, and the only way we're going to come back together is to reopen the wound, talk about this in an open dialogue.
Most of us who have lived with the events of 9/11 have, as a result, experienced some kind of trauma. It can be very difficult to come to terms with what actually happened at the World Trade Center. In fact, someone told me recently, "I wouldn't believe what you're telling me even if it were true." Our petition signers, with psychological expertise, have stepped forward to offer their insight. While this segment is clearly outside the knowledge base of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, these experts in psychology highlight their valuable experience for us as to why this evidence can still be so difficult for people to accept.
At this point, we have years of hard scientific evidence that disproves a government theory about what happened on September 11th, and yet people continue to be either oblivious to the fact that this information exists or completely resistant to looking at this information. So the question becomes, why? Why is it that people have so much trouble hearing this information? From my work, I think we would be remiss not to look at the impact of trauma. My name is Marty Hopper, and I'm a PhD clinical psychologist. I've been working and living for the past 30 years here in Boulder, Colorado. For the past 11 years, my work has focused on helping people who have experienced personal trauma. Now, as we know, the horrors of what happened on 9/11 were televised all over the world, and they were televised, in fact, live. We witnessed the deaths of almost 3,000 of our fellow Americans. We know this had a very severe and traumatic impact on a majority of the population. I myself cried for weeks after September 11th. A friend of mine who is a psychologist in practice here in Boulder said that her caseload increased tremendously after 9/11, and people that she hadn't seen in 10 years were coming back into her practice. So I think it's safe to say that collectively as a nation, because of what happened on September 11th, we experienced trauma.
I'm Fran Schur, and I have a master's degree from the University of Colorado. I've had a private practice as a psychotherapist and as a licensed professional counselor for about 20 years. Why do people resist this information, the information that shows that the official story about 9/11 cannot be true? What I've learned is that as humans, each of us have a worldview, and that worldview is usually formed in great part by the culture we grow up in. When we hear information that contradicts our worldview, social psychologists call the resulting insecurity cognitive dissonance. For example, with 9/11, we have one cognition, which is what the official story of 9/11, what our government told us, what our media repeated to us over and over, that 19 Muslims attacked us. On the other hand, we have what scientists, researchers, architects, engineers are now beginning to tell us, which is that there is evidence that shows that the official story cannot be true. So now we've lost our sense of security. We are starting to feel vulnerable. Now we're confused.
9/11 truth challenges some of our most fundamental beliefs about our government and about our country. When your beliefs are challenged or when two beliefs are inconsistent, cognitive dissonance is created. 9/11 truth challenges the beliefs that our country protects us and keeps us safe and that America is the good guy. My name is Bob Hopper, and I have a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Cincinnati. For the past 29 years, I've been a licensed PhD clinical psychologist in Boulder, Colorado. When your beliefs are challenged, fear and anxiety are created. In response to that, our psychological defenses kick in, and they protect us from these emotions. Denial, which is probably the most primitive psychological defense, is the one most likely to kick in when our beliefs are challenged.
I'm Danielle Dupre, PhD, originally from Switzerland, where I studied psychology and psychoanalysis. For the past 15 years, I've been empowering people who have experienced significant trauma. America is a powerful nation. It has never been attacked. We were confident, we felt secure, and all of a sudden that security collapsed. People started to be fearful. With all those rumors, those news, people didn't know what to think about. And it's a very, very uncomfortable state to be in. And eventually, our mind shuts off. Just like when a computer is overloaded, our minds get overloaded. We can't handle it anymore, and we shut down. It's easier to deny it and move on with our lives.
What some of us will tend to do is deny the evidence that's coming our way and stick to the original story, the official story, and to try to regain our equilibrium in that way. Another thing we can do is decide to look at the conflicting evidence and be sincere and be open-minded and look at both sides of the issue and then make up our own mind about what reality is. I'm Dorothy Lorig. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology from the University of Colorado, and I've been practicing reevaluation counseling for over 16 years. If we can think of our worldview as being sort of our mental and emotional home, I think all of us will do just about anything to defend our homes, to defend our families. And so I see that with people, and I saw that with myself when my brother tried to talk with me about it, of don't mess with me, don't mess with my home, don't mess with my comfort with how things are. And about a week later, I read a lengthy article by Professor Griffin about why he believes the official account of 9/11 cannot be true. And it was a very well-researched article. I was in my office at the time. I sat there, and I felt my stomach churning. I thought maybe I was going to be sick. And I leaped out of my chair and ran out the door and took a long walk around the block, around several blocks, and just broke down. I understand now that what was happening was my worldview about my government being in some way my protector, almost like a parent, had been dashed, and it was like being cast out into the wilderness, I think is the closest way to describe that feeling. And I sobbed, felt like the ground had completely disappeared beneath my feet. And I knew at some point during the walk that I knew that I was going to have to become active
in educating other people about this, that there was that for me to retain any sense of integrity, I was going to have to take some action. I couldn't just let something like this go.
Many people respond to these truths in a very deep way. Some have a visceral reaction like they've been punched in the stomach. To begin to accept the possibility that the government was involved is like opening Pandora's box. If you open the lid and peek in a little bit, it's going to challenge some of your fundamental beliefs about the world.
Well, here are a few of those spontaneous initial reactions to hearing the contradictory evidence about 9/11.
I don't want to know the truth, or I'd become too negative and psychologically go downhill. I'm not sure I want to know. If this is true, then up would be down and down would be up. My life would never be the same.
Fran, I refuse to believe that that many Americans could be that treasonous. Someone would have talked. But these are beliefs. They are not scientific facts. But these beliefs do keep us from looking at the empirical evidence.
I'm David Ray Griffin. I taught philosophy of religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. I published about 35 books in my field. But then, starting in 2004, I started publishing about 9/11. And since that time, I have published 10 books about 9/11. You have empirical people who will simply say, look at the evidence, and if it's convincing, I will change my mind. Other people are paradigmatic people. They have a paradigm. They say, this is the way the world works, and I'm convinced this is the right way the world works. 9/11 doesn't fit into that paradigm. So I don't need to look at the evidence. It's paradigmatic. And then there is a third type of person that we often call wishful thinkers. I call it wishful and fearful thinking. So they simply will not believe something that they fear to be the truth. And I found that maybe to be the most powerful factor of people rejecting 9/11 truth and not even entertaining the evidence.
So whenever we say, I refuse to believe, we can be sure that the evidence that's coming our way is not bearable and that it's conflicting with our worldview much too much.
Denial protects people from this kind of anxiety.
As I thought about all of these responses, I realized that what is common to every one of them is the emotion of fear. People are afraid of being ostracized. They're afraid of being alienated. They're afraid of being shunned. They're afraid of their lives being inconvenienced. They'd have to change their lives. They're afraid of being confused. They're afraid of psychological deterioration. They're afraid of feeling helpless and vulnerable.
I believe that to be the kind of country that we think we are, we have to face some of the things that are not as we think they are.
I'm Robert Griffin. I am a licensed psychologist practicing in Pennsylvania for 25 years. I am a member of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, and I am past president of the Northeastern Pennsylvania Psychological Association. After World War II, part of the way that Jewish people honored the dead was by making sure that the truth was known and that the value of these people was respected. Not pursuing the truth about 9/11 disrespects the value of the life of the people that died. Thinking that we're above such things, that it could happen in other countries, but it couldn't happen here, that's a lack of humility, and that's excessive pride. And so not being able to see our dark side or our weaknesses is the most dangerous thing.
The observation that pride is one of the basic human flaws is absolutely correct. this is especially true for Americans because we for a long time looked at other nations and say, oh, they're in such bad shape, but luckily we don't have those problems. We don't have leaders who would do those things that were done in the Soviet Union or done in Germany or done in Japan and on down the list. So this is a type of pride that Americans have. A feature of American history that makes us particularly liable to this pride is this notion that's called exceptionalism, that America is the exceptional nation. And that began from the beginning as this country was formed. The people would say, well, there was so much evil in the European country, so much cheating, so much lying, so much using the people for the ruler's purposes, but not in America. We have leaders that are free from those sins. So I think this has made 9/11 particularly difficult for Americans.
Anyone can make mistakes, but our ideals and our principles get us back, you know, on track.
This is one of the defining issues of our time.
So we need to understand that questioning is patriotic. Questioning is what we're supposed to do as citizens. That's our duty.
When we come to the national level, when something like 9/11 happens, we need to be sure that we have a real investigation into who the perpetrators are, and then we need to be sure that those perpetrators are held legally accountable. It's part of the healing process on the individual level as on the collective level. We need the truth in order to heal.
The deep wounds from 9/11 have yet to heal. Nothing hits closer to home than the loss that these family members continue to endure, along with the torment of their unanswered questions.
My name is Bob McElveen. I'm from right outside the Philadelphia area, and I'm the father of Bobby McElveen, who was killed in the lobby of the North Tower on September 11, 2001. But I've been searching to get the truth of exactly what happened to Bobby, and Bobby is a very interesting story. Bobby was one of the first 10 bodies found. We took him home that week. Well, I finally found the doctor who examined him. He gave me an outline of a body, and he described all the injuries he had. But the fact is that all his injuries were in the face, the front of his face was blown off, massive cuts in his chest and his right arm were blown off. To me, that means explosion.
My brother was my best friend. David has always been a firefighter. My brother went in to save people's lives. I'm a family member trying to find out the answers to the murder of 3,000 plus people.
I'm Jane Policino. My husband Steve was 48 years old when he was killed on September 11th. I have no identification. You know, why is that? And you're sort of left with all these question marks, which is harder to deal with than the pain of losing somebody in that way. It seems to me we should know why over 1,000 victims there are no trace for, and no identification, no trace of over 1,000 victims.
Just a few years ago, they were still finding body parts on the roofs of buildings. What is that?
We should know why there are over 700 bone fragments found on the top of Deutsche Bank building, less than a half an inch long. We should have that information. Why were they up there? Why weren't they found? What kind of explosion was there?
And the explosions were brought up many a times, talking to firemen, talking to medics, talking to everyone. Everybody talked about these explosions.
I want the officials that are in power to ask the questions. I want answers. We never had answers. Nobody ever stopped to have a scientific investigation.
Please look at architects and engineers, people all around the world, scientists all around the world are questioning this, that these towers could not have come down. But when you bring science into the equation, that's so important because you can't argue against science. And there's some deep, deep explaining to do.
The bottom line is that it needs to be investigated properly.
The forensic evidence that you've seen is very real. New light has been shown. A third beam now reaches into the pitch black sky and stands in for the still officially unexplained freefall destruction of the World Trade Center Building 7. The obvious dark truth about Building 7 may very well provide the key to justice for the victims of the destruction of the Twin Towers.
The country owns this. We were all victims. We all should want answers, not just ours, not just mine. We all lost something that day.